We're a few minutes behind, so let's try and get to our seats. Thank you. Next on our program is an opening general session, and I'm pleased to introduce the moderator, Kevin Madigan. Kevin is a member of the CAS and a chartered enterprise risk analyst. He's a director at Willis Towers Watson in New York, and also an adjunct faculty member in Columbia University School of Professional Studies, Masters of Science in ERM program. He's an active volunteer within the profession and recently served as chair of the joint CAS-SOA Committee on the ERM Symposium and as a member of the ERM Committee of the Actuarial Standards Board. He is secretary of the CAS's ERM Special Interest Section and chairs the program committee for the CAS ERM Seminar. He's also chair of the CAS Risk Management Committee, so he's a busy guy. Please join me in welcoming Kevin and his panel.
Thank you, Steve. So thanks, everybody. And I know I think this session's being webcast. And so first I want to introduce my speakers, and then I'll talk a little bit about how we're going to run this session, and then we'll jump right into our discussion of the underwriting cycle. So sitting to my immediate left is Greg Hendrick, who is chief executive of XL Catlin's reinsurance operations and a member of the XL Catlin leadership team. Greg was formerly chief executive of insurance operations for XL Group PLC. Prior to that, he held the position of executive vice president of the strategy implementation office for the XL Group, and before that, president and CEO of XL Re Limited, the Bermuda reinsurance company of XL Group, and a member of XL's reinsurance executive group. There's a lot more I could say about Steve, but in the interest of time, I'm going to move on, if you don't mind, because you've got quite a storied career.
That's fine.
Next to Greg is Ed Polkstenis. He has extensive experience both as an actuary and as a CUO, as a chief underwriting officer. He's been involved with applying data analytics and predictive modeling to improve underwriting since the mid-1990s in a variety of roles with both regional and national carriers and as an independent consultant. Ed is currently the Executive Vice President of Underwriting for Hamilton USA, a member of the Hamilton Insurance Group, a company started in 2014 with the mission of using data and technology to streamline the insurance process. Ed is a fellow of the Casualty Actuarial Society, a member of the American Academy of Actuaries, a chartered property casualty underwriter, and a certified insurance counselor. He is also a licensed agent for standard and surplus lines business. And at the end of the table is John Shettle. He has 38 years of experience in senior management and board positions in the P&C industry with a deep emphasis on specialty insurance. John currently serves as operating partner at Stone Point Capital, vice chairman and chief underwriting officer of Starstone Group, as well as a board director and chair of Starstone's underwriting and risk committee. John has previously served as CEO and board member of several exchange-listed insurance holding companies. He has an MBA from the Stellinger School of Business at Loyola College of Maryland and earned his BA at Washington and Lee University. So I'm actually quite thrilled with the panel that we've put together for this discussion. I've got a few polling questions. So for the people who are using the app, but also people who are watching the webcast can also participate via the app. I've already made one of the questions live. What I'm going to do is pose some questions to our panel to have them discuss, and then look at the responses that we get on the app. We'll have a few of these questions throughout. And around halfway through today's session, we'll take some questions either from the audience. I think there's microphones set up, or you could, I think that's probably the way it's going to have to go, is to have you come up to the microphone to have some Q&A. So with that, for those of you who don't know, there was a paper in 2012 in the Journal of Risk and Insurance that actually won the CAS ARIA Prize. This paper concluded that any evidence for underwriting cycles in the P&C industry is spurious, and that if cycles do exist, they aren't amenable to forecasting by speculators or sophisticated underwriters. Research from earlier in this century indicate that cycles were real, but they were either lengthening or vanishing. So the first question is, and I'll pose it to Greg, in your opinion, is there now or has there ever been an underwriting cycle? And if so, are these cycles relatively similar, or do they change from time to time?
Thanks, Kevin. And certainly, Kevin shared the paper with the panel. I'm pleased to admit right off, I'm a math major but a failed actuary. I only got through 2.5 of the exams back when this learned institution split them up a little bit. I got to about page three. There was lots of integrals, and I gave up. So thank you for sharing that, though. Probably best I gave up, because I believe passionately that there are cycles in the business. There always have been. There always will be. You can call them cycles. You can call them just a fluctuation of risk margins back and forth, up and down, through the market cycles. They're not that unusual, and they're pretty similar, as I'll talk about in a few seconds, to what we see in all of the capital markets. So I want to talk about kind of three quick things. There's many cycles, not one. The amplitude and the duration of the cycles are changing a bit. And then this is not a different entity or a different market reality relative to any of the other financial markets that we see around the world today. So starting with the first one, there's many cycles. There's never just one cycle at play. I mean, you could sit way back up high right now and say for insurance and reinsurance, short tail lines in the U.S. are fairly stable on the reinsurance side, leveling off, falling a little bit on the insurance side. Casualty is fairly stable around the world. But you really have to keep digging deeper. So if you dig deeper and you look into one that I know well, which is property cat, and has a lot of available data and analytics around it, you know, in that market alone, there's a Canadian market right now. There was a tragic fire up in Fort McMurray, and so pricing in Canada is going up. The U.S., generally because pricing has reached a point at which the return in excess of the cost of capital, whether it's our own capital or alternative capital, is reaching the point where you just can't go any lower. And so it's flattening out. You see that playing out today. And then in Europe, where there's much more capital than there is supply rather than there is demand, you still see prices trailing off a little bit. So just in that one area of the business, property cat, you see three different cycles going on. And you can play that out over and over again. U.S. insurance, we see casualty fairly steady, maybe even ticking up a bit recently, but property still continue to fall. And even within, if you step down another level, within little pieces of this, there's another cycle going on. So you look at European casualty reinsurance, right? Fairly benign, fairly flat, maybe a little down, maybe a little up. But within that particular niche, there's a little market called London casualty excess of loss reinsurance. So protecting Lloyd's, basically Lloyd's syndicates on their casualty insurance assumed book. There's been some loss activity there that's been in the headlines, and there you see pricing and terms going up. So there's many cycles at work. The only time you really see something come together and shift the curves of them all together is when you get a tragedy like 9/11, or you learn something, you know, something like that, where you learn a lot about correlation or indeed the assumptions about your frequency and severity. So the second point is amplitude and duration. If you look at the returns from a kind of a group of the top 25 P&C reinsurance companies over the last couple of decades, you'll see a curve that just keeps the height of it keeps getting lower, but so too does the valleys. So we would have seen kind of mid-teen returns, you know, kind of in the post 9/11. Then you'd see kind of low tens, and you know, and today you're probably seeing eights, nines, somewhere in there. So each time the opportunity to get outsized returns has become diminished in reinsurance. But likewise, you used to have to lose money to get the upward tick going. You haven't seen P&C reinsurance underwriters lose money as an aggregate since 2001. And so there's whether that's just the fortuity of the events or whether that's the fact that there's better diversification, there's fewer players, consolidation, you know, there's a lot of different points you can argue. But if you just look at that industry curve, you can see the amplitude coming in tighter. And the distance between each trough and peak is getting longer. There's less of a whip around action. The market's able to withstand more than it used to. And the third thought is that this is really the same as any other marketplace. Right? You can trade equity. You look at equities. Equities have bull and bear markets. Credit spreads tighten and widen. Government spreads, seemingly in this world today, seemingly only to fall, but eventually they will go back up again. And so forth, commodities, currencies, and so forth. These are all just trades, sometimes driven by harsh economic realities of supply and demand, but quite often driven by the same thing that drives the underwriting cycle in the P&C world, which is that emotive kind of response around, I have something, I fear something, do I want to protect it more, do I want to protect it less, is the value of that protection more or less, and that plays on that risk margin up and down. And people, as we've observed over many years, as people look backwards in the rearview mirror, and there's more and more years in a row when something bad hasn't happened, tends to make the buyer of risk protection value it a little bit less, and B, the seller of it charge a little bit less for it because they get a false sense of comfort. So we've seen these go up and down all the time. I think actually what will change the cycle the next time around may be something more like government yields or corporate spreads, because as alternative capital makes its way more and more into our business, shifts there might be the thing that influence us rather than kind of the traditional, there's a $100 billion CAD or another liability crisis.
Do either of you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I guess I would just add, I agree with all of Greg's points. I guess there's also sort of this behavioral dynamic that I think takes place as well. And, you know, fundamentally, I think it's been true of all these cycles, but fundamentally in insurance, we've got premiums that come in at the very beginning. We know what they are. They are certain. They can be accounted for as the premiums earn in. And then we've got losses. And losses come in later, and they're less certain. And so you have this uncertainty around losses, and uncertainty can translate very quickly into hope. And as they say in one of my favorite movies, The Shawshank Redemption, hope is a dangerous thing because it can create all kinds of behaviors that start to move managers towards short-term decisions rather than looking at long-term decisions. And I think that's a really important dynamic. And I think one of the things that's changing the behavior of these cycles is that hope is getting replaced with information. It's replaced with data. It's replaced with more facts that lead to sort of these micro cycles. So one company sees something and they start to move in a particular direction. Another company misses it, and then they have to respond in some other way. And I think as more information comes into the equation and hope gets replaced with information, and the uncertainty of those losses actually comes closer in time to matching up with the premiums based on that information, I think that's an interesting dynamic that is sort of influencing these cycles as well.
Yeah, great. And I would agree with both my colleagues here, but also disagree with the paper that Kevin presented at the beginning that there isn't evidence for these underwriting cycles in the property casualty market. Certainly agree with
oops. Sorry about
Greg's
that.
Assertion that there's cycles within cycles, but also looking back over the past 40 years, there's a couple very highly discernible, what I would call macro cycles that the industry's been through. 74 to 76 was incredibly intense downward cycle. It was very much influenced by macroeconomic conditions, both in the United States and worldwide, which included very, very high inflation rates, oil prices, a very, very stagnant economy. It was a period called stagflation. Had enormous impact on our industry and on profitability and on economic activity that the industry insured. Probably the one that was most pronounced and most clear and crisp was 85 to 88. During that period of time, and I think I'm aging myself, unfortunately, it's how long I've been in this industry, but that was driven by very different causes. Toxic torts, asbestos had a big role in that. It actually ushered in, after an enormous period of negotiation with regulators, the claims made policy completely changed the way that casualty insurance and reinsurance was underwritten. At the end of that period, and probably 85 to 88, after those changes took place, price increases were up 100, 200, 300%. Policy forms were changed. Probably some of the most profitable years that the industry ever experienced. And then January 1, 88, it was like somebody literally turned off the light switch, and prices went down. And we saw probably one of the most interesting and prolonged soft market cycles, which was, I would say, January 1988 till some indeterminate point in 1999. So 11 years, briefly interrupted by Andrew in 92, where we all, I think to Ed's words, had hope that prices did go up for about 9 months and then promptly went down again. And then 94, post-Northridge, a little spike up in prices, and then we went down again. That down cycle really didn't really reverse itself. People think it happened in 2001 with all the events in 2001, but the cycle really changed in 1999, and it was a result of years and years and years of cumulative underpricing followed by huge under-reserving and the interrelationship of those two. That's when Travelers announced over $1 billion reserve shortfall in medical malpractice. St. Paul, Munich, many of the major reinsurers had significant reserving issues as well. And the market really changed then and began to move upward. And I think the what we really saw then after 2001 was an enormous contraction in supply and also fear that then made that market more exacerbated. But the turn really happened in 1999. And so I think these cycles are clear. When this most recent downward cycle started, we could probably all have our own dates in mind. It's less clear, but probably sometime in 2012, 2013. And I think also people misunderstood how, particularly in the casualty lines, that pricing really was better than they really thought it was for longer than they thought it was. So each of these cycles really has its own attributes, although behavior within the cycles stays the same. I think the other area of very interesting commonality is that if you were a stock picker looking at this industry without any real knowledge of the industry, you would come to a conclusion during the hard markets that it was almost indistinguishable from company to company, right? All the returns look kind of the same. But when you get these downward markets, you really begin to see enormous divergence. You can already begin to see it in the second quarter, third quarter results. And we begin to get divergence between the really good companies and the mediocre companies. Beginning to see that now as part of this cycle, which I think you see in every one of these cycles, that when it ends, the stronger, much stronger, and some of the mediocre have been consolidated out or for whatever reason are no longer there. So I think that's another kind of common feature that we see as well. So, Kevin?
Well, not surprisingly, there were 198 people that voted, actually, which I thought was pretty good. But 96% of them, 191, said, yes, of course there's cycles. So I'm going to open up another question here that's related to the question I'm about to pose to Ed. So given that if cycles do exist, can investors and managers, can sophisticated investors or underwriting managements of underwriting companies reliably forecast underwriting cycles?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that as we mentioned, as cycles become more murky, they get a little bit tougher to see. They're not as clear as maybe they were back in 10, 20, 30 years ago. I do think that it's a little bit of a different story when you think about being in a soft market and trying to predict when a hard market comes versus being in a hard market and trying to predict when a soft market comes. I think, if you're looking for, how long are prices going to last and when are they going to start to soften, to me, that seems a little bit easier, if for no other reason than hard markets just don't last that long. So there is just the passage of time that takes care of that. But as you see capital flowing in, as you see slower economic growth, and, of course, every company has an appetite for growth. So if your appetite is to grow, say, 4% a year, and the economy is growing at 4 or 5% a year, that's actually not that tough to do. If the economy is not going anywhere and your goal is to grow 4% a year, then the only way to do that is to start to take share back. And if recent profits have been good, have been positive, then there's definitely even more of an incentive to do that. I think being in a prolonged soft market and trying to predict when that's going to turn, I do think gets a little tougher. I think often it's a shock that takes place. A lot of times it's due to a catastrophe or some other kind of shock that takes capital out of the market unexpectedly. And I think it's also the case that whether or not you're in a soft market in one of these microcycles is probably in the eye of the beholder. I mean, I remember some examples in my past where we had very unique value propositions. We had maybe some unique talent, and we went into some segments of business and were very successful doing that. And I'm sure that our competitors looked at us and said, I can't believe how soft the market is. But because we had a particular model, we had certain talent, maybe we had certain information, to us, it wasn't a soft market. It was actually a great market, and we were very, very profitable doing it. So I think companies are always looking for sort of those types of pockets.
Sure.
No, you can't predict them. You never know when. I think that subtlety between hard and soft is a great one. And when you get into soft, I love what you said about hope. Today, analytics takes away some ability to hope, but not entirely. My favorite hope thing is hope is not a strategy, which is one I learned very early on. You just can't wish your way out of something. It's very difficult to, you can't predict them. You can't predict when they're going to change. You can try to measure where you are, where you think you stand in the cycle, where you would like to try and head as prices reach a certain point. When you've got, again, a line that I know well just because of my history of the property cat line, when you've got a model, which, by the way, are always wrong, they're going to be wrong in specific events, they're going to be iterative learning processes, you can get to a point where you can say, though, in the bottom of it, and that's what John, I love John's history, by the way, I was in the 85 to 88 cycle, that was when I started, just so, hope you shared. I didn't get back to the first one, unfortunately, the 70s, so... It comes to a point where you say, whatever my cost of capital is, I'm just not making it anymore. Now, back in 99, that meant your entirely was your own capital. It was your entire equity, right? That was what drove, I mean, a little bit of debt. That's what drove your cost of capital. Today, it's a much lower number because you're blending in all this alternative capital, which most of it's coming from sources that are only demanding kind of a 4 or 5% return relative to negative to very low government spreads. You see a lot of the pension fund money coming in. I totally agree with that. It's definitely in the eye of the beholder. It's definitely one person's view of what's an appropriate amount of margin. People have been able to survive through this lower cycle of pricing in the cat world because they've accessed lower cost of capital. When's it going to change? I don't know. Could be an event. Could be a retraction of that capital. But you just don't know when that's going to happen. So you got to be able to find a way to persevere through it.
I think, again, agree with my colleagues. And I think part of it is also in the semantics here. You absolutely cannot, I think, forecast down markets. But I think they also become foreseeable at various points in time. I think all of us in the trade, everyone here in the room, all of us here at this table, you know, 2-3 years ago, it was very foreseeable that we were going to go into a softer market. And some of the criteria there that you evaluate is periods of very high profitability, which then attract other capital into the business, right, or attract people putting more capital, existing companies raising more capital to support a growing business because it's profitable. Inevitably leads to supply-demand imbalances. A great example right now, and to Greg's point of a cycle within a cycle, perhaps the greatest supply-demand imbalance is in Asia, right? And that also results in perhaps the softest pricing and the weakest underwriting results, just for that very reason of imbalance. We also see whether or not there's ease of entry to the market. So can new entrants get in easy or not? If they can, that also is a portend of worse times to come. Tax arbitrage strategies such as the hedge fund phenomena that we're seeing now that makes it attractive for hedge funds to, in essence, become, you know, reinsurers in order to, gain beneficial tax treatment for their investors. And also, as Greg mentioned, global interest rates, which now attract the enormous size of the huge global pension funds to come into the industry as well. The area that we really cannot forecast or foresee is when these cycles end. And to Greg's point and Ed's point, it's factors that we never see coming. And I would also say it's generally always more than one thing. Oftentimes, it's kind of like the old adage is bad things happen in threes. And I think if you were to look back at all of these cycles, three really bad, ugly things happened all within, say, 12 months. And it was the convergence of three really bad things that then, you know, caused the industry to really shift gears, supply to diminish, fear to increase, and prices to rise. People to withdraw capital from the industry. And when that happens is, you know, kind of anybody's guess, and none of us will ever see it coming, I think.
So I do think
one of the things I find most interesting about this conversation is, you said it, it's semantics, right? When you get a nice, and I actually love that paper, that academic paper that said cycles, if they're real, are not forecastable. Because you get into the semantics of what do you mean by a cycle? It's obvious that there are market dynamics where markets are soft or markets are hard, I think. So the voting is interesting. On this, and I apologize, I didn't really know how to use this app very well, so I think I turned the question off and then turned it on again and didn't even realize it was completely off. But we did have over 200 responses, and people are now throwing in more votes. 59% say that no, cycles are not forecastable, and 40, well, now it's 58 to 42, but I'm gonna shut this thing down, because I want to do, what I want to do is open up. Because I don't know how easy it's going to be for people to get to the microphone. So you could also submit a question on the app, and in particular as well, people that may be watching the webcast. We're happy to take questions right now before we continue on. If people wanted to respond to anything that was said here or ask any questions, I'll give you a couple of minutes, or actually a couple of seconds probably. Let me go ahead and move to the next question while you... think about any questions you might want to ask. This question was I'm going to pose to John. It seems to me that with everything that's going on with changes in our capital bases, there's a lot of insurance company operating models are under pressure. The capital providers definitely have changed. And then you've got the rise of enterprise risk management, capital modeling, predictive analytics. So much that's going on now, this could potentially... permanently alter the nature of any cycle that may exist. Cycles have existed in the past, but is what's going on now in the industry, could that eliminate them or prolong them or completely change the nature of the cycle, or is this just yet another thing that's going on that, as we continue to evolve?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think one of the things I hear from a lot of young people in our industry, you know, and young, I mean professionals in their 30s in particular, is they say, gosh, has it really changed? Is it really different now? Is it a different business? And I think the answer to that is no, but. And I think all of the changes that Kevin just mentioned, and regulatory mandates in particular, are likely having a dampening impact on down cycles. But I think they're also, for reasons I'll go into in a minute, I think they're also having an impact on lengthening the cycles. And I think also to Greg's point, the industry really hasn't had what I would call while individual companies have lost money, the industry as a whole has not lost money for a really long time. And that is interesting, and I think that has a impact. So, Kevin mentioned capital allocation models, sophisticated for a small number of companies, fairly primitive for others, maybe having some impact. I think the one that is having the most impact on our industry is ERM, in particular. And the reason why is that everyone has a big interest in it. Boards in particular, you have ERM committees now on public company boards. Regulators have a huge interest. Rating agencies over the past 5 years have taken a huge interest in the strength of your ERM. And then, finally, that means management teams have to pay a lot of attention to this as well. So if of all of these factors that may be having the most impact on dampening and lengthening, it may be ERM practices, including the advent of the very early advent of aspects like Solvency II that people pay more attention to. The business that might have the most cycle stability at this point is the property cat business. And again, the what I would say, the congruence of both the wide acceptance of modeling as well as corporate governance associated with ERM, it becomes almost impossible for companies to cheat and price risk below the model output. Now, that being said, do you still see some cheating in the sense that for a large national account, a large global company may charge the mean cat rate, but then throw in the fire and all other peril for free, right? Because they say, well, I've got the mean cat rate, which takes me out to 10,000 years, and I'm not going to be working here 10,000 years from now, so I probably have rate adequacy. So it's not an absolute cure, but it does create kind of a bottom of which rates are unlikely to go lower. Other classes of business, we don't have that clarity of models and pricing yet that kind of can manage that. We can't eliminate cycles, we can only dampen them. The reasons are there's always going to evolve, for all kinds of macro reasons, supply-demand imbalances, and that will feed either a harder market or a softer market. There will always be some element of naive new capital that enters into a market that has an impact. So I think that's something that it just doesn't go away. The other point I would make is that there is a potentially, and others have spoken about this, so this is not any new thought, and I think many of you have heard this before, there is some potential negative impact of kind of the increasing governance of ERM and regulatory oversight. And it may make product innovation and what I would call good risk-taking really less feasible within our industry, in the sense that trying to introduce a new product in a insurance company or reinsurance company today, the questions by the ERM team and the actuaries will be, well, where's the data? What data do you have? And the response is, well, there is no data. It's a new product. Well, what are the pricing models? You know, can you have a product without a pricing model? Which becomes a bit of guesswork. And I think we already see it today. There's a lot of stifling because of these factors in our industry. And the final thing that may be negative is a point that I made earlier, in that we may not see this bifurcation of good from mediocre, and we may not see really the great companies in the future, because if you were to really take a view that all of this is taken to an extreme, including Solvency II, and perfectly implemented and perfectly governed, you would end up with an industry that looks like an electric utility business, where everybody's going to earn about the same return, and there won't be companies that fail, but there also won't be great companies that overachieve. And that may not be a good thing for our industry or for the economy at large, as we may not be as good at solving the next issue or next problem. So I think it's well worth mentioning that as that occurs, there is some risk associated with the dynamism of what really is a great industry.
Yeah, I mean, I think John made a number of great points. I just wanted to pick up on two of them. First, you sort of alluded to the issue of price and how some of these ERM and other mechanisms really put controls on that. And I think that's a really important point, because I think that companies are starting to move away from, hopefully away from price as being sort of a primary means of competition. And so companies try to move towards being product specialists, or maybe they move towards specializing in customer experience, or trying to resonate with their customers in ways that go beyond price. So I think that is actually a really important dynamic, and I think that's one of the reasons that we see the cycles tending to get a little bit more murky. It's not just price is all moving in unison one direction and then moving in unison another direction. It's getting much more varied. The other comment, I think it's really interesting. You mentioned that, you know, there's great dynamism in insurance, and you know, I never really thought about that, but you're right that if these boundaries, these controls move to the place where you just can't be nimble, where you can't continue to move in an industry that's not really known for being nimble historically, right? Let's face it. That would be a real shame, because the world is moving ever faster and faster. I mean, the world is starting to spin pretty fast with things like new technologies. You've got drones, you've got self-driving cars, we've got the sharing economy, the way that people are engaging, and the exposures that are coming out of that engagement is is really changing significantly, and I think it's really it'd be really great for the insurance industry to be able to respond to those types of exposures and respond to those types of opportunities in just as dynamic a way.
Yeah, I think nimbleness is a great word, creativity, innovation, whatever. I think we're going to come to that in a few more minutes. But if I go back to John's question at the top, is it really different? I can tell you for sure in my 30 years, it's really different. If I look at the internal and external sources of review and oversight, if I start with the internal, and some of them I know John may have mentioned, but you got enterprise risk management, you got internal audit, and you've got your board and your external auditors that are signing off at least on your reserves, your accounting and your finances and your reserves. So there's four groups that I think I would certainly submit that one of them didn't exist before, and two of them, internal and external audit, are much, much stronger than they used to be. Now you go to external, you got regulatory. If you're a global carrier like XL Catlin, you're exposed to, we're regulated in one shape or another, some heavier, some lighter, between the states and the U.S., European under Solvency II, and then wherever we have branches around the world in places like Singapore, Zurich. I know Zurich's in Europe, but it's not in the Solvency II regime. Sometimes it's fascinating to me anyways that regulatory frameworks don't really honor the meaning of the words Europe and so forth. And then Brazil and emerging markets, which is another whole different piece of it. Then you've got Sarbanes-Oxley, some of the response after the financial crisis of some of those rules. If you're publicly traded as an SEC company like we are, there's another whole set. And yes, while markets are very fairly even across the globe today, I can certainly testify to the combination that we just did, the standards and reporting that has to go into an SEC company versus one that might be listed on the London Exchange or some of the other exchanges, they are different. They are different. And I would say as a U.S. traded company, we are exposed to much more oversight and watching than we used to have before. And then John mentioned the rating agencies as well, which I know hate to be called the de facto regulators, and they're not the de facto regulators, but they tend to do at the end of the day become the ones that are determining how much capital you have to hold, because when you look at the equation in just quite a simple mathematical modeling way, you know, you've got your own internal model, you've got your regulatory capital, and you've got your rating agency capital. And I've been in a number of organizations, and the rating agency's capital has never been lower than the other two. So I know they're not the regulator, but their capital requirements kind of drive what you are. So just with all those things going on around you, it's got to do what I think is happening, which is dampen the highs and lows and stretch out these periods in between wherever you are in those cycle. I thought the good versus mediocre question as well was a fascinating one. I think there still will be good, but I think the difference will be what we all grew up with, which is the risk-taking, underwriting, pricing of the business was a differentiator between good and bad. I think it's going to be on the expense side. I mean, if you look at PNC today, on average, you know, certainly in the U.S., 40 cents of the dollar still goes to pay all the expenses to make this happen. It doesn't go to the, in the end, all we do is provide a promise to pay, and only 60 cents of the dollar goes to that promise. The other 40 cents goes to expenses. So I think we will get better at risk-taking. I think we will get better at pricing, and the nimbleness is definitely key. But I think a lot of what's coming will be a lot more efficiency and expense, and that's maybe where you end up being your differentiator between good performance and mediocre.
One point that Greg made that I really I think is really important to make, really important to emphasize, is expense and cost management, expense ratio. I think maybe moving, if we buy on that these softer markets may be longer, more dampened, and that government monetary policy may continue like it has been globally, that expense and cost management moves from something that, wow, that gives you a bit of outperformance, to something that is highly strategic. And I think that Greg is making that point, and I think that is something that probably more companies need to be thinking long and hard about, because it may be as important as all the other functions, and has not, I think, been raised to that level of deep corporate strategy. Yeah.
We've got 17 questions came in on the app, so I'm actually pretty happy about that. So I'm going to ask a few of them, and I'm going to save one of them for quote-unquote last, because there were three or four different ways that one particular question was asked. But a couple that I think are pretty interesting. One is a couple of flavors of this question was, do you think the primary insurance cycle leads the reinsurance cycle, or vice versa? What do you think the impact is between the direct primary insurance cycle and the reinsurance, or even you could throw in excess, direct excess as well?
Well, history would say reinsurance, and if you go all the way out to the esoteric retro, which is, for those of you who don't traffic in it, reinsurance of reinsurance, that always drove the rest of it, because as the capacity tightened back in the back of the chain, so reinsurers' cost to provide protection went up, it then got passed on to insurance companies, and insurance companies reacted and passed it on. I certainly lived through, I managed XL's insurance business around the globe from 12 to 14, and we got what I would call a double whammy helper. We had a little bit of lift on the pricing side of the insurance. When I say a little, low single digits were going up in that period on insurance pricing, while reinsurance pricing, particularly on, we've been talking about the property lines, was cratering the other way. So they get those. It's just this product of there's different underwriting cycles through all these different pieces of the industry, and they get out of sync with each other, right? And so we crossed over. Now you see insurance giving away more rate, reinsurance starting to try to pull that. So, you know, you could argue you could do a chicken and an egg here. They are interconnected. They are reactive to each other. But sometimes there's something that causes one to push ahead faster or harder than the other, and it may not push the same way at the same time. Would be the way I think about insurance and reinsurance.
I agree with what Greg is saying, and I think it also comes back again to, you know, kind of the supply-demand equation. One thing I would say that's been a bit different, if you buy into we're in a bit of a soft market now, that as compared to, say, the 88 to 99 cycle, reinsurers are much, much more disciplined than they were during that period, large and small reinsurers. You know, clearly, and this is not just our industry, it's any industry, you know, generally the closer you are to the person paying the premium, the more market power you generally have, but not always. So clearly, you know, cycles start with too much capital, supply imbalance, producers shop and push down prices at the primary level. Primary companies, as their premium deteriorates, tend to then hold more risk, buy less reinsurance, that pushes down reinsurance prices, et cetera. And generally, the umpire, the entity that stops the cycle, generally but not always starts again with the reinsurer, right? And the reinsurer then begins to raise price. When that happens, it puts a real crunch on the primary, who then doesn't have a choice anymore. It's not even a 15-minute discussion. They have no choice but to raise price. And generally, they have to both raise price and buy more reinsurance at the same time. So it tends to make hard markets very exacerbated for some period of time. Again, not clear as to whether that's been the traditional story, not clear that that will be the forward-going story. You know, the other area that's quite interesting and I think still a continuing story is the amount of consolidation that's been taking place at the reinsurer level. And that is having a real impact on, again, that level of discipline and controlling the amount of reinsurance capital. And I think that's something that we haven't mentioned earlier in the discussions. That's another factor I hear that is dampening where we are now.
Nothing to add.
Okay. There's a couple of good questions here, but I'm going to ask this one. How can insurers manage the behavioral aspect of the cycle? Do companies have effective incentives to minimize the negative impact?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that impact the behaviors. You know, first, I think is this. I'm going to come back to this lag between the recognition of premium and losses. And I think that, particularly from an actuarial perspective, to the degree that we can use actuarial techniques, we can use the most contemporary data and analytics to understand what those costs are going to be, the 60% that we pay back to the policyholders. And I think shortening that and bringing more certainty to it is something that really would bring quite a bit more stability to the cycle. So if we sit here today, certainly I would never trade somebody a $20 bill for a $10 bill. But, you know, if I were to get a $20 bill or a $10 bill today and I knew that I had to pay $20 in the future, I don't know. Maybe you forget about it. Maybe something changes in the future. There's always hope, and hope is a dangerous thing, right? And so I think that by bringing that certainty back to the present, right? No, it's a $10 bill for a $20 bill. You're not going to make that trade. There's actually an interesting story in the book Supercrunchers. I don't know if any of you have read the book Supercrunchers, about this economist who was also a wine connoisseur. And he got interested in the wine markets, particularly the French wine markets. And it's a fascinating story about how he used modeling techniques to predict the quality of wine and therefore the value of wine right after the harvest season. And so you had the traditionalists who were looking at wine and breaking open the barrels 18 months, 36 months, 48 months after the harvest. And then you had this economist who's looking at the weather, essentially, for the summer and predicting the value right at the end of the harvest. And so he took this information that previously was not known, namely the quality of wine, not known until 48 months out, and brought it right back to the end. And by doing that, was able to really, really fundamentally change how wine prices behaved. And I think there's a lot of applicability for that in the actuarial sciences as well. I haven't been on the reserving side for quite some time, but I don't see as much, I don't remember seeing as much, and I still don't think I see as much use of predictive analytics in reserving as I do on pricing. And I think the behaviors and the details of how that book of business, that portfolio evolves over time is something that I think actuaries can add a lot of value to.
I think that's a great question that was posed. And I think human behavior is human behavior, and it really hasn't changed much in over 2,000 years. If you read how business was conducted during the Venetian period or whatever, right? But I think that in terms of managing human behavior, it goes back to the concept of where you see this divergence in good companies versus mediocre companies. It starts at the top. It starts at the tone set by the board and by the senior management team, in that people don't chase top line. People remain focused on bottom line. I think to the point that Greg made earlier, people begin to get focused on cost management and efficiency, and a determination to be willing to write less business and hold margin and come through better and stronger. That's where human behavior is very well managed by, I think, the better, smarter management teams in the business. Those companies always come out. If you look at the really big successful companies in our industry, look at what happened to those companies in the 2 or 3 years following the end of a soft market. Their growth is just phenomenal. And the other thing, I think, is willing to be opportunistic. The other part of human behavior is fear. And I won't tell you the name of the company, but at the end of 2001, after the airliners were crashed into the World Trade Center, et cetera, up until that point, the whole airline industry had been able to buy war risk with a $2 billion limit as part of their whole liability package for not even pennies, right? I mean, it was essentially thrown in. The day after those attacks, the 72-hour clause was invoked, and so all of that war risk coverage was automatically canceled. So airlines had no war risk. They had to go back into the market to buy it. At this point, it was the best time in the history of airlines to write war risk, right? Because no airplane was going to be attacked. It was just not going to happen. And fear took over. And one company stepped up. And instead of writing $2 billion of coverage, they offered the airlines $50 million of coverage for a premium of $20 million. And guess what? All the airlines had to buy it. And so now those prices, again, are back to pennies on the dollar. And the limits are no longer $50 million. But, again, that was a situation where smart management teams were able to kind of control that human behavior aspect on the other side of fear and realize opportunity and take advantage of it. So, I go back to this concept of it's really the good companies that are able to better manage human behavior than those that just basically follow what we think is what happens with human behavior.
You know, this conversation of Ed's talking about hope, and you brought up fear. Several years ago, I was in a runoff company, and I had a mentor there who one day just said, you know, the insurance industry is run by a combination of fear and greed, and everything's fine as long as one of them doesn't get the upper hand. If greed takes over, you know, we know what happens, and if fear takes over, we end up not doing things that we should do. And you know, when he said it, I laughed, and I thought, oh, how funny. But there's some insight to that. You know, you have to have the fear and the greed have to be balanced properly, and if one of them takes over, that's not good. I don't know if you had anything to add on the behavior.
Yeah, now you've got me on another one, so I have to thank goodness I'm writing things down today. You'd hope you live in a world of fear, definitely, no doubt about it. Unfortunately, fear is one of the bigger sellers of insurance, particularly in the P&C world. You'd like to hope that we can come in as an industry and solve and alleviate those fears and let companies keep going forward, right? With this, they don't have to worry about this P&C risk that they have when they're making cars, planes, or whatever else, so they can keep moving forward. I hadn't thought about the greed part before. It's interesting. Is greed, you know, it's one person's view, right? Is the 20 million for 50, is that greed, or is that just the realism that you don't know how many people are hidden where, trying to do what
practice.
To try and be? Yeah. I think going back to the incentive piece of it, I meant to say at the top, most of my comments are based on being a large commercial insurance and global commercial insurance and reinsurance company. So this isn't as applicable necessarily all the time to personal lines, small commercial, but you look at publicly traded insurers and reinsurers, you can look at their comp plans and how they reward their people. There isn't one that I'm aware of. Unfortunately, from time to time, I have to be a studier of these, particularly when people want to get comped every year, and not one of them has a top-line component to it. It almost always will be return on equity. It'll be tangible book value per share growth. It'll be some metric that measures what's left over as profit at the end of the day, not how much did you grow. You know, I don't know enough about the personal line space because maybe there's some dynamics of lower risk, more incentive for growth that exists. But certainly in the space that I think the three of us live in, day in and day out, those incentives are there's no to a disincentive for growth when you're being compensated on margin instead of top line. And then reserving, you know, applying predictive modeling to reserve. We certainly haven't seen that at XL Catlin yet, and certainly it's one of the things that, as we keep our conversation going here, you know, I certainly have a view that's a very fruitful exercise. The what's the value of going through the last 20 years of large corporate excess casualty insurance reserves and squaring off the triangles versus the reality of what exists today is the market reality. Today is the risk profile. Probably bears, if not nothing, certainly very little of what it was 20 years ago. And so this need to not do away with the current traditional methods of doing things, but supplement them with kind of looking forward more than looking back, because it's likely that the last 2 or 3 years are most going to be informative to you rather than the last 20 years.
So as you would imagine, we had three or four questions that asked a version of, given the political and economic uncertainty, in particular the presidential election, do you think what impact do you think any of that, you know, the low interest rate environment, the prospect of who our next president is going to be, all the turmoil that's going on in a lot of the European countries as well, do you think what kind of impact do you think that'll have on the insurance cycle?
I did see a really interesting presentation. It was by the Insurance Information Institute. I think it was Bob Hartwig who did a study on this. And he went back, I think, to the last 25 or 30 years, both Republican and Democrat administrations. And he looked at the, I think it was the return on equity in the insurance business. And the numbers were almost perfectly even. So based on that data, you would say it doesn't make any difference who the president is or who's in power. And I do think to some degree the world sort of falls into two baskets. There's the basket of things you can't control, and there's the basket of things that you can control. And I think that within those things that that we can control, I think that those are going to have a much greater bearing on our success as an industry and on our success as individuals, both within companies and for our companies. There is just so much inefficiencies still in the insurance process, and Greg alluded to this a little bit earlier, the 40 points in the expense, for example. Underwriting, even as far as it's come, still has inefficiencies. There's questions that either are not very good questions, people don't know the answers to, the information is spotty. There are processes that take weeks for customers to get policies in their hands, and so those inefficiencies are things that we can manage. There's things that we can kind of take into our own hands, I think I haven't seen any other evidence on the political side that there's any impact one way or another.
Yeah, I think it's probably a positive that our underlying business is risk and uncertainty. So I think we don't necessarily, to your point, say, wow, this is more, it's more uncertain because we live in uncertainty. That's what we try to manage. I think one area that, though, has been very, kind of helpful on the political side is that while the life insurance didn't, the property casualty industry generally avoided most of the implications of Dodd-Frank, which put enormous costs for regulation and compliance on banks and life insurance companies, and that would have already increased again the cost burden that Greg mentioned of an industry that's already kind of pushing a 40% cost ratio. So I guess my sense is, irrespective of governments or administration, I think the only macro that we all really face, and Greg mentioned it earlier, and particularly for entities like Excel that do business in many, many different countries, you probably have 10 or 15 different regulators at least, and oftentimes those regulators have differing views and regulate things. So one thing that is permissible or mandated becomes unacceptable to another regulator, and it does really increase the cost structure of our business. And I think that's probably not going away. And, I think the regulatory burden, no matter what administration is there, wherever it is in the world, is more likely to get, I think, tougher rather than easier. And so I think companies that can manage that better and more thoughtfully and more efficiently are in a more, kind of competitive position.
Yeah, I want to give you an opportunity to respond, and then I know we have a question.
Sure, I'll be very brief. We've touched the third rail of politics. We'll go to religion next after this one, just to make it a round out. What John was saying was, and this is not to pick on the Greek government, but under Solvency II, Greek government debt gets no haircut as capital, whereas our U.S. corporate bond holdings get haircut under Solvency II. So, and I'm not here to debate which one's better or worse, but there's clearly some kind of mismatch.
They're different.
Mismatch there. They are different. But I would say, I would submit one's riskier than the other.
Yeah.
In general, these guys said it, people keep buying insurance. Yes, sometimes they have less to protect, both individuals and corporations, but people buy insurance through any kind of government there is. I think if you wanted to try and look at a business one, but it's been a very kind of a false signal, at least in my time, general wisdom would be a more left Democratic president and would lead to higher severity on the tort side as federal judges got appointed, Supreme Court, and then when you swung it around, more conservative, the system would get more friendly. We certainly haven't seen that in the data. Now, it takes time to play out. The Obama appointees are just getting going, and you have to play through, legal cases have to come before them and play through the system. But thus far, we haven't seen that. And I would say in the previous, quote, Republican administrations, we didn't see really a huge one the other way, absent the big tort reform we had back in, broadly, in the late 80s, early 90s. Yeah. So I hope that was as generic as I could be without offending anyone.
Your question? Oh, the mic's not on. Oh, there we go.
There we go.
So my question has a bit of a risk management spin to it. Lower profits in a soft cycle tend to increase economic capital requirements, as profits provide less of an offset to losses and capital needs in a capital model. So the dynamic is changing. As companies move more towards performance measures that are risk-based, we'll now have decreasing numerators and increasing denominators on our returns. as companies look at things like risk-adjusted returns on capital and so on. So just wondering if you have any thoughts on this issue as companies move more towards this basis and how it amplifies the cycle.
I think your assessment's absolutely correct, and I think it then does... it can have kind of the weird impact of exactly what you don't want to happen, kind of numerator effect then does create an incentive to try to grow the business at the wrong time because that expense base is growing. And, you know, and one of the behavioral aspects that you see at this part of the market is lots of companies that are in, say, 10 businesses expanding into 3 new businesses, right? And there are businesses that they look at on paper and they say, wow, well, X, Y, and Z, they're all doing well at this business. We should get into it too because they're getting 93% combined ratios. We have the distribution. We have the ability to go to do that business as well. And that helps with that numerator effect. And the impact of that is, yeah, they might get some growth, but then it tends to continue to drive the market down because there's more supply entering a market. And so that actually creates the kind of behavior that perhaps you don't want in this market. But your assertion and your assumptions are, I think, absolutely correct. It's another tension and pressure on the industry that has to be thought about and managed.
So... we actually, we only have a few minutes left, and two of our speakers have tight flights they have to catch. So I'm going to pose this last question to you, which I think is going to be pretty, we may run out of time. Just how different will the future of insurance product pricing and underwriting look? Or how different will the future be for insurance product pricing and underwriting? I think there's a potential for some really radical change, but I'd like to hear your thoughts over what the next 10 to 25 years will bring.
I'll leave you with one quick thought that's not mine. At our company offsite this summer, we went to Cambridge University in Cambridge, England, and we had a guest speaker that has spent his entire life on artificial intelligence and expert decision making, and his lifetime work has been what are the risks to society from the growth of AI, and. He had really, this guy was a complete absent-minded, brilliant professor. He didn't really understand that he was speaking to an insurance audience when he made his presentation. But at the end, he had a list of the 20 occupations that were most imperiled and likely to go away in the next 10 to 15 years. And insurance underwriters were number 2. So, and it was, you know, just kind of, and at first when you looked at it, you said, no, that's ridiculous. On the other hand, you know, you'll see it very large insurance companies, kids coming right out of college, master's degree with math backgrounds, et cetera. They go in and their job is to collate all the data from Walmart or another large global account. They plug it into the models. And the rate comes out for the cat risk, and that's it. And it's done. And so there is no underwriting that is taking place. It's all been systematized and made me think about it. And that could be enormously changing and disruptive to our industry if that gentleman's correct.
Yeah, if I could just play off that. I mean, 30 years ago, I was a pup in the reinsurance business. I'd go visit carriers, small carriers in the U.S. that still had something called a personal auto underwriter, somebody that actually looked at a submission on your car and tried to figure out whether you were a good risk or a bad risk. And 20 years ago, when you would have gone into some of the companies around the United States, you would have seen something called a homeowner's underwriter. Now, there's still a few of those left because there's special acceptances or they got to drive these predictive models. And you now go to small commercial. You start to see less and less underwriters. I'm quite frankly actually surprised it wasn't number 1 on the list of the jobs going away. I think we'll keep making that move up that complexity of risk curve. I mean, we've done some work. Others of competitors with us have done some as well around kind of professional liability and some of the heavier. Whether we get all the way there to the tough, what I would call the toughest of the tough risks, the Fortune 500 property schedule, the liability policies, I don't know. But I think the technology is, there's a lot of forces we've talked about. We've talked about global We talked about regulatory. We didn't talk about distribution, thankfully, because I don't have to explain my views on distribution. But the main one that we see that influences our industry is around technology and change. And I certainly see a world where you're harnessing the Internet of Things, you're building external, you're accessing external data sets that have nothing to do with the loss history you've had the last 10 years. I mean, you can get into commercial trucking now and commercial auto in the U.S. You can go to the Department of Transportation and go access every reported vehicle accident there is over the last 5, 7, 8, whatever number of years it is. You don't even have to have your own book of business anymore. Now, yeah, there may be problems with it. You may need to clean it up. But you just keep marrying these external databases, some with your own and some of it with kind of these huge data sets of wearables and sensors and so forth. My personal view is that going forward, the skill sets that you need to have in this room will at least be balanced between being able to be future thinking and predictive modeling and kind of what I would call the more historical data set usage. And probably if I wanted to be a little more provocative, it'll probably be a little bit more or a lot more on that future-facing predictive modeling type of approach.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that the process of insurance is fundamentally about transferring information. And if you think about the traditional process where a customer walks into an agent or a broker and they fill out an application, in the old days, paper applications, but they still don't look that different than paper applications today. And that application goes to a broker, and a broker either sends it to a company or they might input it into a company's system. And if it doesn't work there, they may have to input that same information into another system or send it to another company, and the company then asks questions, and there's another application process that goes on. And these questions, they might be good questions, they might not have answers that people know, but they do the best that they can. And a couple of weeks later, the customer gets a policy. And if you think about so many other things that have changed in our lives, we just would not tolerate that kind of a buying experience in so many other areas of what we all do. And so I think there's a legitimate question to be asked as to when we reach the point where those types of transactions are just happening online in real time. And it really is just about moving information. If that information can move faster, if the information can move more efficiently out into the system, out to the capital providers, and back from the capital providers to the customer, that's really what has to take place in order for that customer to get essentially an immediate response. I can tell you that in our organization, we've examined this question, and we said this. We said, is it possible to underwrite a small commercial account using nothing but their name and address and information that's out there? And we've been doing pilots this year on that premise. And there is an awful lot of information out there. And a lot of the information that's collected through traditional processes actually we found is not as reliable as sometimes traditionally we think it is. So I think certainly we're going to be moving in that direction towards better information, more efficient information, and definitely much faster information in the service of the customer.
Yeah, I keep thinking that there's a large chunks of the P&C, large sec parts of the P&C business, where we could end up in a situation where you've got the capital modeling that's driving what you want your risk profile to look like, and then you've got the predictive analytics that tells you, as you're looking at a risk and trying to decide whether to bind personal lines, small commercial in particular, is at what price will this particular risk make my risk profile get to where I want it to be? And make those decisions so fast once we get the technology rolled out. And obviously there's a lot of challenges around regulatory issues around the distribution channel in particular, but you know, if you could solve those problems, I could easily see so much insurance being bought the way we buy things on Amazon now. And the capital providers are sitting back as pools of capital that are constantly making these automated go, no-go decisions as millions of transactions a week, if not a day. I don't know if any of you had any other closing remarks.
I do, but I don't want to make them late for their planes.
Well, we still, according to my clock, got 2 minutes before we're supposed to close.
And Ed and his firm are definitely unburdened by the legacy issues that many of us have that make some of these big leaps forward possible. But I totally agree with Ed's view of the world, and you see people today making the offer of insurance from an email without anything, even the name and the address, just going out and getting that on their own and making an offer. Now, it's all preliminary, it's all test, it's not done yet, but I certainly see the world going in that direction as opposed to the more traditional grind-it-out exercise we've been through in the last 30 years.
And what kind of an impact is all this going to have on the cycle? Just
continue to compress them and make them longer? And less cyclical?
Yes, but and you know, also something other than just what happens to us in our risk business will drive an uptick.
Right.
Credit spreads blow out, so people that are investing in this asset class want to see a certain size return for the same expected loss that they do in that asset class, and that may that they would withhold their capital until they could see that kind of return to quality rather than what we've historically experienced of something bad happens and we have to react.
It'll be interesting, too, to see if a different type of cycle sort of emerges between technology and this idea about underwriters, you know, maybe not having underwriters in some period of time, because models can do funny things as well.
Oh, yeah.
And so you could see a scenario where everybody moves very, very aggressively towards data, and things don't always work out the way you think they do. And you could see somebody saying, we've got to get people back involved in this. So I think finding that right balance between the human intelligence, the artificial intelligence, I think is going to be really exciting. And I think it's definitely going to change the nature of the cycles as we move forward.
Well, with that, I'd like you to join me in thanking the panel here. Steve?
Yeah, I'd like to thank the panel. I thought it was an excellent excellent discussion, thought-provoking, interesting. So thanks to all of you for coming, and safe travels. Before we leave, a couple of quick announcements. Please complete the evaluation form for this session and for all the other sessions that you attend. The program committee uses the feedback directly in planning the next meeting, so the information is valuable, useful, and helpful. Next on the agenda is our luncheon. Thank you, and enjoy lunch.